On this episode of China Unscripted, we talk with Terrell Jones, who was a reporter in Beijing in 1989, about what he saw happen in Tiananmen Square, the time he ran from armed Chinese soldiers, and how one bad translation changed the media narrative about Tiananmen. Welcome to China Unscripted. I'm Chris Chappell.
I'm Shelley Zhang.
And I'm Matt Gnaizda.
And joining us today is Terrell Jones, an instructor in international journalism at Claremont McKenna College, and was an Associated Press correspondent in Tokyo, Paris, and New York from 1982 to 1997. But he was also in Beijing for a major historical event. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for asking me to be here.
Sure. So you were there in Beijing on June 4th, 1989, the day, as the Chinese Communist Party says, absolutely nothing happened. What was that like?
I had gone to China on May 12th from my base in Tokyo to help cover the visit of Mikhail Gorbachev, which was a huge event, the thawing of the Sino-Soviet estrangement after 30 years. So that was my purpose of going to China, was to cover the Sino-Soviet summit. Gorbachev was going to come and meet Deng Xiaoping and other Chinese leaders and make happy and ease tensions between these two communist giants in Asia. And that was of great concern to Washington and Tokyo, Seoul, and other countries in the region. And so that was the big story on our minds for about a day, because the next day, I arrived on May 12th, and on May 13th, a number of students started a hunger strike on Tiananmen Square. This was sort of a continuation of their protests in April when Hu Yaobang died, and there was a great outpouring of grief and mourning for this leader who was seen as sympathetic to the students and the everyday man. So, by the time Gorbachev actually arrived on May 15th, just a couple of days earlier, the square was so overrun by protesters and hunger strikers that the Chinese couldn't hold a welcoming ceremony for him there. And it was almost as if the students were a bigger story from the moment Gorbachev arrived, because they were controlling the agenda.
Do you think Gorbachev felt shafted? I mean, there he was in China making history, and yet all anyone can talk about are these protesters in Tiananmen Square.
Well, he was kind of at the roots of it. The students, many of them pointed out glasnost, you know, the Gorbachev policy of openness and transparency, and demanding it of their own leaders. And there were even posters and banners that equated Mikhail Gorbachev with democracy. And so, he probably didn't get what he wanted out of the trip. I'm sure he wanted a lot of pomp and circumstance and attention. But he played a bigger part in it than he probably realized.
I mean, one of those parts he played was simply that there were lots of foreign journalists there like yourself who otherwise wouldn't have gone to China at that time.
There were hundreds of foreign journalists in Beijing at that time with permits for live satellite link-ups, extra press accreditations for assistance, and press rooms set up for both the Chinese and the Soviet delegations in hotels in Beijing. And so the red carpet was pulled out, and the Chinese authorities were expecting it to be a kind of an arrival on the world scene of a modern China. You need to keep in mind, this is 1989, and there had never really been a worldwide event or news event of global import that was being broadcast live daily. This is sort of the origin of what some people call the CNN effect. CNN was there with a number of other networks, but CNN was a 24-hour cable network. And so they were always broadcasting about what was going on in Beijing. And that really attuned a lot of people and news consumers, I think, to the notion of turning on the TV at any time and being told right away what was going on about the biggest story in the world. Unwittingly, yes, the Chinese authorities and the at the time Soviet authorities unwittingly played a great role in the enhancement of press coverage of breaking news.
Well, that's absolutely delicious. So were the protesters violent in calling for an end to the Communist Party?
The protesters weren't violent at all. They were on a hunger strike to attract attention to their demands. Their demands were such issues as transparency by the government, a dialogue with the government, a recanting by the government of calling their earlier protests for Huiyabang and the current hunger strike, and a retraction of calling it a counter-revolution and chaos and hoodlumism. They also wanted, I thought rather presciently, they called for Chinese leaders to divulge their wealth and assets.
But they're humble servants.
Nonetheless, they were still, I mean, I remember one sign that I saw of a protester. I took a picture of it. Somebody riding in the back of a small pickup truck, and the sign said, "Erzi Shiguan Dao Zama Ban," which is, you know, the children are corrupt. What are you going to do about it? So pointing to nepotism that was well known among the Chinese people at the time. So, you know, that kind of corruption is not new, and the idea of the leaders being selfless servants of the people was certainly not widely believed.
Do you remember what the atmosphere was like back in mid to late May?
Oh, the atmosphere was it was euphoric. It was incredible. It was a journalist's dream. Every day we would wake up knowing that we were covering the biggest story in the world, but we didn't know what direction that story was going to take that day. We knew that we were going to be the top headline of all papers in the next day, but we didn't know what our lead was going to be. And I think for a journalist, that's actually a dream story. You know, you don't want to go to something that's so scripted that, you know, you could write it without even going. And that happens, you know, too often these days. The crowds were euphoric. You mentioned mid to late May. You know, this is after martial law was declared around May 20th. And the hunger strike, that was 7 days after the hunger strike started. And then you go forward another week, May 27th. Actually, that was kind of a downtime because people had been kind of petering out, and the protests had been petering out, and people were retired. A lot of the students had returned to the Beijing universities, and other students from the YD, you know, from the outside mm-hmm. areas had come in to take their place. Not completely, but some of them. And then they had this brilliant stroke on May 29th, I think, to bring in the Goddess of Democracy statue that had been created by the students at the Academy of Fine Arts, Central Academy of Fine Arts. And that just reinvigorated the spirit, and it became kind of the carnival it was. But by that time, 3 weeks after the protests, still there had been no real concerted effort to try to remove the students from the square or to end the protests. You know, after martial law, Li Peng declared martial law and the premier, and they had sent in army trucks, and they were immediately surrounded by thousands and thousands of citizens and protesters who scolded the soldiers and asked them why they were there, what did they think they were doing, did they know what they were doing, and then brought them bananas and instant noodles and things to eat. And so, you know, how can you attack a citizenry that treats you like that? But I don't think their orders were to attack at that time. So the atmosphere was thick. It sounds like a cliche to say that the air was so thick you could slice it with a knife, but that's what it felt like. It was tension, it was euphoria, it was uncertainty, a lot of apprehension about what might happen next, and amid that, a genuine belief that China was on the verge of regime change.
Well, so during the protests, you and the other Western reporters must have had some fears that the government was going to crack down on the protesters. But did you have any did you imagine what was coming?
Short answer is no. Nothing to that extent, of course. There were rumors always. You know, I mean, the word "yaoyan," you know, for rumors was just everywhere, because there were rumors that soldiers were in the sewers beneath the square, ready to jump out at any moment. There were rumors that the 27th and the 38th armies were in a shootout battle between themselves at a nearby Air Force base. Rumors that leadership were going to resign. A lot of people started and I think perpetuated rumors that they wanted to believe. But soldiers did start to appear in early June. It's not as though they suddenly appeared on the night of June 3rd. Around June 1st, and so there would be a few of them would come out from either the Great Hall of the People or the Museum of Chinese History that faced it on the other side of Tiananmen Square. There were a battalion of soldiers that I saw. I couldn't count them, but I saw them camped out in an open construction area, sort of a little bit west of where the opera house is now. And so people knew that soldiers were in the area. On the night of June 2nd, I was in the AP Bureau, which was in the Qijiayuan diplomatic compound that overlooked Chang'an Boulevard, and I heard these odd shuffling and grunting noises, and I looked out the window, and there were these large squares sort of in marching formation of soldiers jogging toward Tiananmen Square. This was like 24 hours before the actual assault with tanks and rifles came. These were young soldiers, unarmed. They looked like teenagers, and they were jogging toward the square from the east. And I followed them down there in a car, and as dawn broke, they were confronted and turned away by angry Beijing citizenry, many of whom had poured out of their apartments hearing that this was going on, and turned these soldiers back. I mean, sent them kind of straggling back to where they came from with their tails between their legs. You know, they were hot, they were exhausted, they didn't know what they were doing, they were confused, they were young, and they were unarmed. And that was a major humiliation. And I think it might have been a deliberate provocation, you know, Chinese authorities knowing that, okay, if we do this, we'll send these youngsters in without guns. You know, the crowds are going to turn them away, and that will give us an excuse to come in with the real hardware. So all day long on June 3rd, that was probably the most tense day that I've ever experienced. And again, we didn't know what was happening, but all kinds of rumors flying around. Soldiers are coming. They're going to come from this direction. They're going to come from that direction. And then after the sun went down, they actually did come in, this time from the west.
So where were you when the massacre began?
I was staying in the Beijing Hotel at that time on the 11th floor in the room that overlooked Chang'an Boulevard, and I could see basically the top half of the square. You know, tanks and AK-47s are really loud, in case one doesn't realize that. I hadn't realized how loud they would be. You can hear them from very far away. And so they were approaching from the east. There were a couple of armored personnel carriers that were running around kind of randomly over on the west side of the square. One of them got stopped right in front of me. It tried to run over some fencing from the square that people had pulled across the street, and it got stuck. And people were throwing rocks and sticks. I mean, kind of a Stone Age attack on this armored personnel carrier, and then set it on fire, basically, with Molotov cocktails. And eventually they forced the crew members out. I was watching this, and they set upon these soldiers, but there was sort of two factions. There were citizens who were furious and trying to beat up these soldiers, and there were others who looked like they could have been students who were trying to protect the soldiers. Eventually they hauled them off and put them on a bus, and I don't know what happened after that.
Who was hauled off, the students or the soldiers?
At least two crew members of this armored personnel carrier were hauled off by people who appeared to be students and put on a municipal bus, one of the many buses that had been driven out there, either to block the path of any oncoming assault or to be a shelter to the protesters.
And you were watching this all from your hotel room?
Well, I was watching this from the street. I was on the ground with them, and I was taking video. I wasn't taking much photos because in those days you had to be very economic with your film and your videotape, which is what I had. So I was taking 8mm analog videotape at the time here and there. And I, a lot of times I didn't want to take something because I thought something more important might happen. And, you know, gee, how much time do I have left on my my machine? How much batteries do I have left? So I was taking a few videos here and there, not many photos. At one point I went back up to my hotel because I was filing radio reports back to AP Radio from my hotel telephone. And I went back in. It was sometime during the night. It was before the tanks had reached the western edge of the square. And I kind of walked into a trap. There was a plainclothes police, public security officer, and three uniformed police in the lobby of the hotel. And they stopped me as I was trying to bustle up to my room and searched me. And they found this videotape that I had and confiscated it. And it was close to 2 hours of video that I had taken over the previous several days. I said, "What are you doing?" And there was a hotel staffer there who was standing by kind of sheepishly and powerlessly. And he just said, "Ha ha, moshola, it's been confiscated." You know, and so I lost that 2 hours of tape, which I've obviously never recovered. I did go up to my room from there and was filing reports. And that was the time when the tanks and soldiers came onto the square. They turned the lights off of the square, so you couldn't really see what was going on. I did take a picture at night when the lights were still on, and you could see that the Goddess of Democracy statue was still standing. So it was sometime, I don't know, right after midnight probably. I had been told that I couldn't leave the hotel, that I was basically under sort of house arrest. So I spent the rest of it overlooking the rest of the night overlooking the hotel and filing reports by telephone.
What was the feeling when you realized what was happening?
Well, you could hear the guns, like I say, from quite miles away, it seemed. I never thought that they were shooting people on their way into the square. I thought tanks. I said, "Wow, this is kind of overkill, but this is the decision that they reached to have to make it all the way into the square." I did see people get shot. I saw people, and as the sun rose, it didn't stop. They didn't just shoot their way into the square at night and then stop. The soldiers formed a cordon, a line that all the way across Chang'an Boulevard on the east end of the square. And I was on the outside. My hotel was on the outside of that, a few hundred yards away. And then the Chinese people, if you know Chinese people, you know that they love to kan re nao. They love to go see what's going on. And so there were crowds of people out on the street and in the middle of the street. And what would happen was the soldiers would rush forward and you'd hear a lot of gunshots. You'd see all kinds of abandoned bikes and jackets left in the middle of the street as everybody fled. The soldiers would walk back to their perimeter, and then people would come in and load people who had been shot and take them away on these sanwenshe, the tricycles, to take them to some of the nearby hospitals, such as the Xiehe Hospital, Peking Union Medical College. And that happened repeatedly. And so, the Chinese say no one was killed in the square. I believe that. I believe no one was killed in the square. The bulk of the fatalities were on the boulevard approaching the square from the west, where the tanks shot their way in. They didn't come from the east. But there were people who were shot on the eastern edge of the square on the morning of June 4th when these soldiers and the people who went to Kanruna would just repeat this cycle over and over.
So instead of it being called the Tiananmen Square Massacre, it should just be called the Beijing Massacre.
Yeah, I mean, the protests were centered at Tiananmen Square. The journalists all it became a buzzword. Journalists had shorthand for it, calling it T squared or T2 or TS. And so it became known as that. So, but you're right. I mean, the word Tiananmen Square massacre is kind of a misnomer.
It's interesting, though, that how I don't know if you know about the people who are kind of like Tiananmen Square massacre truthers, who like there's a, especially among young Chinese people, there's this whole thing about it didn't happen. That was nobody ever got shot, and like they kind of used that information about the fact that nobody was shot in the square and kind of twisted to make it seem like that means nobody was shot.
Yeah, it's twisting words. On one hand, it's twisting truth. On the other, you know, there was a news conference a few days afterwards that the AP got in trouble for, because the AP was one of the few who attended this event, and the reporter who went was not a Chinese speaker and worked off of the translator, and the person giving the briefing was talking about soldiers coming in to clear the square and said Wang Xiang, and the Chinese official said Xiang Tian Kai Le Qiang, which means they shot into the air, toward the sky. And the translator, instead of saying Xiang Tian, translated it as Xiang Guangchang. So misinterpreted the official as saying Tiananmen instead of Tian. And so the interpreter said, and the soldiers shot into the square. Whereas the original words were the soldiers shot into the sky. And AP reported that, and the Chinese got super, they were furious about that and made that reporter come in for a tongue lashing and obliged AP to issue a correction. But it was the faulty material was actually supplied by the translator. Those kinds of things can add to the debate or the mystery over what really did happen when.
I'm curious, what happened to some of the people that you interviewed while you were there?
Well, that's one of the kind of gut-wrenching realizations that a lot of reporters had after June 4th, because until that time, like I said, it was sort of a reporter's dream in reporting a huge story, but you didn't know what the outcome every day was going to be. The people on the square were so euphoric and so certain that they were on an unstoppable trajectory that everybody talked openly, giving their names and their schools and majors and hometowns and things like that. And of course, Western reporters are supposed to ask people's names and their ages and their occupations and their hometowns and include as much of that as possible when interviewing, which many of us did. So we don't know what happened to the people we interviewed. I got to know some people better. I would see them repeatedly, and I didn't quote them because I didn't, not because I was concerned of them being hurt, which I should have been, but I was concerned about blowing my sources. I didn't want to name people who were either providing me information or opinion. But many of the student leaders, you know, we know all the ones, you know, Wu Kaixi, Wang Dan, Li Lu, Chai Ling, Zhang Boli, etc., were widely quoted all the time in the press. And they were, I think all of them were on the most wanted list of 21 people sought after the square was retaken. So I can only imagine that those were the ones who were publicly named, and many of them were caught and jailed by Chinese authorities. What about all those who weren't prominent leaders or figures, but nonetheless were named in all these news stories by Western reporters? So I don't know, but it does make me heartsick to think that something bad might have happened to any of them.
Were you ever concerned about your own safety in the midst of this?
I took some foolish risks. As a younger reporter, you know, I hadn't covered wars before at the time. I knew that one of the regulations of martial law was that you couldn't use binoculars or cameras, and that there were sound trucks that were going around broadcasting through speakers. Anybody using binoculars or cameras could be dealt with on the spot. And I asked somebody on the what they meant by being handled, and they said, "Oh, you'll be shot." And I knew that. I kind of foolishly felt that, well, I'm a journalist and I'm a foreigner, and it didn't apply to me. So there was one night after June 4th, I was driving south on the west side of the Second Ring Road, and I heard a number of machine gun blasts. And somebody had said, you know, oh, you can't get close because they'll keep you away. And I realized that there were no other cars on the street. I pulled over immediately, turned off my lights, and I said, there's one time that reason got the better of me, and I said, okay, I'm going to turn around and come back. But worse than that was around June 6th or 7th, a big column of soldiers was marching east out of the square. And I had a bike. I was out there at the time. And I saw them, so I took some pictures from the side, from in between trees. And then I pedaled down to a place where I was way ahead of them at the International Hotel, which is at the big intersection where the main train station at the time was. And I positioned myself in the middle of the street facing them, the front of this column, and I was taking pictures with this 200-millimeter lens. And I had planned my escape route that if I needed to, that I would just go over to the International Hotel and go inside, because I had been inside and I knew my way around. So these guys, they came closer, and one guy started barking out to soldiers, and I saw two of them start running toward me. So I said, okay, this is where I go to the International Hotel. So I ran across the street, from the middle of the street, across the northern half toward the International Hotel, and I heard two very loud gunshots ring out. I don't know if they were aiming at me or aiming toward up. And so I just kept running, and I got up to the International Hotel door and found that it had been barricaded from the inside and wouldn't open. There was a small Mian Bao Che, the little minivan that was parked right in front of it. And so I just ducked down behind it, between it and the door to the hotel, and furiously began unwinding my film and pulled the canister out and stuck it in my sock would not be visible, and just waited to say, okay, whatever's going to happen is going to happen. And they didn't come. And so I looked out from underneath the minivan, and I could see them walking away. They had come pretty close, but I guess they had assumed that I had gotten inside the hotel, and so that it wouldn't be worth it, or would be too difficult to go in to try to find me for whatever purpose they might have. So I just waited for them, this whole battalion or whatever, to pass. And when they had gone well past the hotel, I came out and went in the other direction and hopped over a fence back to where I'd parked a bicycle. And there's a crowd of Chinese there who had been standing, you know, onlookers, just watching all that was going on. And when they saw me, they all burst into applause and gave me an ovation, which was quite unexpected.
It was like a play.
I mean, yeah, it was not in intentional, and I certainly wouldn't do that again. And that's why I say I was rather foolish in putting myself into danger like that. Those are back in the days when news organizations didn't offer their reporters a hostile environment reporting training. Now it's almost mandatory if you go to a place like the Gulf. And I did do it, but not until 2011.
What about a place like, I don't know, Hong Kong?
Well, in Hong Kong, I wouldn't be worried about being shot, but I just saw this morning a video of a photographer being very directly, I wouldn't even say tear gassed. It looked like it was a hose, like a garden hose of pepper gas that was sprayed directly on him. And that's what I would be worried about for being in Hong Kong. at this point, I wouldn't worry about being shot. But as we speak, these protests against the extradition bill are getting more and more intense, and I think Hong Kong police are being very restrained in the kind of reaction and security that they're providing. But you know, they're not Chinese soldiers, and so, you know, in the event that Chinese soldiers ever show up, or after 2047, if they're there, I would be worried.
Do you think the Tiananmen Square massacre was a turning point in Chinese history?
You know, it's always been a big question. You know, China had such dramatic economic development in the years after Tiananmen. You know, was it because the Tiananmen crackdown happened? Was it despite the Tiananmen crackdown happening? I do think it was a turning point because you haven't seen any mass protests against the government since then. Nobody dares. On the public side, on the Chinese side, on the government side, they don't allow it. I mean, they know where they went wrong. You know, I lived in China in Beijing as a reporter from 2010 to 2013, and I would go past the Tiananmen Square frequently because I lived on the east side of it and my office was on the west side. I would frequently drive past it, and sometimes very late at night or in the wee hours of the morning, and I would pass the square and I would look out and I would try to count how many police cars or police vehicles I could see that had their lights flashing. And it was usually around 12. And that would be at like sometimes even 3 in the morning. So I figured if I could see 12, then there was probably, you know, 25 others that I couldn't see. You know, the government is very aware of any group of people with a grievance. On Tiananmen Square, one time when I went, I went many times. I don't remember if it was on one of the anniversaries or not, but there was a group of people taking a souvenir picture in front of the, with the Gate of Heavenly Peace as a background, and they pulled out a banner of their company and just held it in front of them, you know, as a souvenir of, you know, Company ABC visited Tiananmen Square. And immediately a couple of uniformed policemen rushed over and told them that they had to stop, they had to put that away. And it was nothing provocative. It was just a souvenir picture. It wasn't like a Tibetan flag or anything. So after they took their picture, I sauntered over and asked them. I said, "Hey, what did those policemen tell you anyway?" And they said, we couldn't do this because of trademark issues, that we're not allowed to use the image of Tiananmen for advertising purposes. You know, and I said, "Oh, how clever. You know, that's an excuse you can use at any time for any activity, and it sounds reasonable. You can't really argue against it, but it doesn't really belie what the true motivations are." So I think it was a turning point because, I mean, another turning point is the internet. I mean, imagine if the internet had existed for people. Imagine if cell phones and Twitter had existed, or Weibo, then the protests would have gone nationwide instantly. And already they were in more than 80 cities, thanks to Chinese media coverage. But what if there had been such, you know, blanket internet coverage? Just people, again, with grievances. You know, they do protest. They go to the Office of Petitions and they go to their local city or provincial offices. But it's not political protests such as you know, a leader, not like the Li Peng Xia Tai, you know, mm-hmm. Li Peng must step down, the slogans that we heard before. It's more individual cases, you know, the grievance, you know, my land was taken from me, or this company or this neighbor is polluting, you know, where I live. So the Chinese government has realized that they can allow protests. They have to allow a way for people to blow off steam or to express grievances. But there are certain kinds of protests that they cannot allow, such as calling for leaders to step down or for changes in the government or criticism of the party. I mean, we've seen that in the bombing of the U.S. bombing of the Chinese embassy in Belgrade, I think in 1999, the EP3 incident in Hainan, where the American spy plane hit a Chinese fighter and was forced to land in Hainan in when was that? Was that 2003? I don't remember. Yeah, back then. And the virulent anti-Japanese protests of 2012 over the Senkaku Diaoyu Islands disputed between Japan and China. All of those, there were very vociferous protests by Chinese citizens against either the U.S. embassy or the Japanese embassy, to the extent of quite serious vandalism, breaking windows, throwing rocks and breaking windows at the U.S. embassy, throwing eggs and water bottles at the Japanese embassy, while riot police just stood by and let them, the protesters, swing by in waves, unload and then go to reload and come back for another pass to throw more things at the embassy and chant anti-U.S., anti-Japanese slogans. Many of those were bussed in the case of the anti-U.S. protests, and certainly facilitated, enabled in the anti-Japan protests. And then the next day, everything was swept away, and they say, okay, you can go home now, and it's over, and we have to let traffic back through because it's a Monday. I mean, it's clear that the government facilitates protests that are to its for its purposes, that don't threaten their own existence, there meaning either the party or government institutions.
Right. I mean, I believe Article 35 of China's constitution says we allow freedom of speech as long as you're speaking ill of hostile foreign forces.
Well, that says it all. In that case, that's the worry is that such protests might morph into something like what we saw in 1989, because it's kind of a tinderbox. It could be very a small step to go from a protest against a state-owned enterprise that is polluting a city to spread beyond that to, oh, well, this is a result of the policy and the party, and that's the one thing that authorities don't want to see.
Well, thank you so much for joining us and sharing your story about Tiananmen.
Well, thanks for asking. I think it's a story that should be understood, should not be covered up. Among my students, I have a number who are from China. And they're all very curious about what happened, because they know that sometimes not until they get here, but they do know that there's something that happened that they're not allowed to learn about or speak about back home. And so they're quite intensely interested in what happened. Sometimes they challenge it, and that's fine. And I think that this, history is something to be debated, but not to be swept under the rug.
Well said. So thank you, everyone, for listening. Once again, I'm Chris Chappell.
I'm Shelley Zhang.
And I'm Matt Gnaizda.
See you next time.